Hi, everybody. Cheryl Atkisson here. Welcome to another edition of the Cheryl Atkisson Podcast. Should we literally declare war on the next pandemic to try to cure some of the ills from the past? If the government isn't going to fix what went wrong, we have to do it ourselves, says the guest of today's podcast, renowned cardiologist Dr. William O'Neill.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
There are so many smart people weighing in on what went wrong with the pandemic and the government's handling of it and the medical establishment's handling of it. We're not hearing all of those voices on, I guess, what you would consider mainstream sources. Some of them were speaking out all along, and I interviewed a lot of them for this podcast and for my TV program, Full Measure. Today, we're going to revisit with someone I spoke to during the pandemic, the height of the pandemic, when he was investigating as part of his job the potential effectiveness of hydroxychloroquine as a preventive measure for COVID-19. He'll talk in this podcast about how that effort got derailed due to politics, not science. Dr. William O'Neill is a pioneer in the world of interventional cardiology and structural heart disease. He's a pioneer in the use of angioplasty as it applies to the heart. When I first met him, he was director of the Center for Structural Heart Disease at Henry Ford Health System. He's still an emeritus affiliated with the same system. He'll talk about some of his bona fides in just a moment. But he has some really important things to say, and I think some fearless reflections on what the government and the system did so wrong during COVID. And I think it's important to recognize, though very sad to say, that there's not going to be any meaningful accountability or restructuring to make sure that we don't make the same mistakes, to make sure that the government doesn't put out the same sort of disinformation. Nobody's been held accountable. Even some of CDC's staunchest supporters had agreed that that agency needs to be rebuilt from the bottom up. Some in Congress promised to do so, but virtually nothing has happened except they've been promised a greater budget going into the next year. So if there is to be change, Dr. O'Neill thinks, as do I'm sure many others, it has to somehow come from us, more from the bottom up, if our leaders aren't going to institute change on their own. He has some ideas for what we ought to do, some very unique ideas that he's going to express to us today. Here is Dr. William O'Neill.
Sorry, I'm the emeritus director of the Structural Heart Center at Henry Ford Hospital. Previously, I served as the dean of research at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. And prior to that, I was the head of cardiology at William Beaumont Hospital for 17 years.
We're going to talk today a bit about some of the things you've observed or some of the things you've learned in light of this COVID pandemic and the way things were handled. But before we get to that, can you give me a little bit about your background? You're quite the esteemed, I guess you're a cardiologist, right?
Right.
If you people want to Google your name and look you up, they'll find a nice history there, Dr. O'Neill, O'Neill. But go ahead and tell us a little bit.
Well, thank you, Cheryl. I've been privileged to be involved with cardiology and cardiac research for almost 40 years. I started the initial research into using balloon angioplasty to open up blocked arteries in patients that were having heart attack. And about 20 years of research from 1980 to 2000 actually led to the widespread adoption of angioplasty as a preferred treatment of heart attack. In fact, around the world, angioplasty is the dominant way of people that treat heart attacks based on the studies that we did in the 90s. I also am involved with something called structural heart, which is valve therapy. I did the first TAVR valve, fixing diseased aortic valves without surgery at William Beaumont Hospital in 2005. And I've been involved with treating emergency heart attacks with massive heart failure called cardiogenic shock. I did the first study in cardiogenic shock in 1987. and have been studying this. And now I'm the co-principal investigator for the first major randomized trial of cardiogenic shock that's going to be done in America in the last 25 years. So I've been really intimately involved with clinical research, and in particular involved with randomized clinical trials.
Well, we're going to talk about some larger policy issues, but before we get into that, I wondered if, as a heart doctor, have you made some observations in the wake of COVID/COVID vaccines? Both of them, I'm under the impression, can cause heart effects.
Yeah, it's.
But are you seeing any changes or differences in patients?
No, we've seen patients that have side effects, and those side effects are reported to the Vaccine Adverse Reporting, or VAR, system to the FDA. And the numbers of reports of adverse consequences from COVID are very large. They haven't been very well studied, but the reports are certainly far greater than they were for the flu vaccine, for instance. And we have seen patients that have had myocarditis as a result of COVID vaccines.
But do people get that also from COVID? Is it a complication of either thing, the vaccine or the disease?
Well, the COVID involvement is at the very end stage of the disease, when patients develop this this enormous immune response, where the whole body has this sort of called cytokine storm, and it does directly involve the heart and causes massive heart irritability, and is the cause of death of some of the patients. But that's at the very, very end stage of COVID. It doesn't happen early on, and it doesn't sort of heal and go away.
For the vaccine patients, does it happen earlier in the process?
Yeah.
Like, they have a heart attack? Is that the first sign, or are they getting just sort of small damage along the way?
No, it's small damage. It's myocarditis. They found some patients that have had myocarditis as a result of the vaccine, and that's an inflammation of the heart muscle. It can present with chest pain. It can present with arrhythmias. We don't really know whether or not it causes sudden cardiac death.
Interesting. Well, in terms of looking at sort of a look back at what we know so far after, I think, what was a disastrous response to COVID, even after the billions we spent preparing for a pandemic and funding for this eventuality that everybody said would happen. What are some of your thoughts that got you interested in what was going on and how we were responding to it?
Well, early in 2019, when we first heard that this epidemic was coming to the U.S., our hospital leaders wanted to try to start preparing. We'd heard that there are a lot of patients that required ventilators in China, so we're kind of gearing up for that. And at peak, when we were involved, we had over 180 patients that were actually on ventilators in the hospital, and we almost kind of broke capacity. So New York and Detroit were the two cities that were the hardest hit. And as a result of that, our leaders asked me to organize a research response. And so I got a group of people from cardiology, from infectious disease, from other disciplines, from pulmonary, to kind of come together and try to see if we could come up with an organized plan for studying the disease, since it was happening right in front of us, and also to try to see if we could mount some kind of a response for it. So we organized a research endeavor, but we had real difficulty funding it. And that was part of our problems and our concerns, was that the way that people were conducting research is based on old-fashioned NIH-type rules, where you have where you kind of have the leisure to do it, to write up a study, submit it for grant funding, and then have the grant funding occur a year later. And the whole thing was really disorganized. When the NIH first started doing their research, they went to their old buddies. So they went to academic hospitals. Here in Michigan, they went to the University of Michigan, who had no COVID patients, when we were inundated with COVID patients, and they didn't even talk to us. So the whole thing is kind of all the research response, which has to be one of the first lines of defense for our patients, is to understand the disease and see if you can figure out how to treat it. And that was just really very, very poorly organized. It was sort of a top-down dictated from the NIH. And there was no pharmaceutical grant because there was no therapy available. The one drug that we studied was hydroxychloroquine. And we thought that we had a very good response here at Henry Ford Hospital. But there was no funding for it. The pill cost 40 cents a pill. Again, as an example, hydroxychloroquine has been approved in the United States for over 70 years, is one of the few drugs that is approved during pregnancy, and there's absolutely no side effects from it. But because of the politics, somehow it became a Republican drug, and the media and everywhere were bound and determined to prove that it was dangerous. And that really kind of was really harmful for our scientific process to try to quickly find cure for the disease during this emergency pandemic.
To what do you attribute these flaws? First of all, that the most obvious, or one of the most obvious places where funding could have and should have gone for research was like a hospital like yours, but you didn't get
Right.
it. And that the government didn't seem interested. In fact, in some respects, interested in funding, they seemed interested in stopping studies about things that could have, that many clinicians who were treating patients in the field thought was proving to be helpful to their patients, like ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine. How do we explain the system that's that broken, that's what happens?
Well, I think that we have to get the politics out of it. And as I suggested to you before, I think that we have to kind of treat this as a war. It's not the Nazis, or it's not the Japanese that are attacking us, it's a virus. And how do you respond to that? Because, you know, more people died of COVID in the United States than either World War I or World War II combined. So it is a life-threatening problem for our population, and we have to come up with better ways of organizing response very early. What we crucially need is early data that's systematic and that is comprehensive and that it's accurate. When we first started looking at COVID, we were concerned that it was going to affect kids, and it didn't. And relatively quickly, that data became important, but people kind of ignored that for whatever reason, to keep the schools closed. We knew that it didn't affect young adults. It was young adults were not in our hospital. The people that were in our hospital, unfortunately, were minorities and were very overweight. And that combination really was lethal, but that really was never established. And people, I don't recall anyone sort of saying that one of the biggest risk factors for severe COVID was morbid obesity. And that was true. But nobody would address that. So having accurate information early on will help, but I think it has to be more fundamental, Cheryl. I think that there has to be some sort of a national response. And what I would suggest is having Congress declare war on the next pandemic virus so that we can organize a response. And yes, we may need to abridge some civil rights, but it's only in a time-limited fashion, and it's only because of the response of the Congress that has the power to declare war. And so I think if you look at it that way, then I think we can do a lot of things that may, in the short term, abridge people's rights, but in the long term, be helpful for the whole population. And
well,
by that,
let's dig into that more in just a moment. But
sure.
Before we move on to that, the whole notion that you, as you say, primarily the worst affected were obese people. I certainly heard that early on, but it seemed as though there was a concerted effort to make everybody think they were going to die. You know, that
right.
That children were going to die, that healthy young people were going to die. And in fact, for a book that will be published next year that I was researching called Follow the Science,
right.
The misinformation CDC put out there, and this is in the record now, some of this has been tracked in scholarly articles. There were something like 8 major data mistakes that they perpetuated uncorrected even after told about it, that all greatly exaggerated the risk to children as a result of, you know, that was how the mistakes never went the other way, saying, you know, oh, this is an error, but it understated the risks. It always made it look far worse for children. And a lot of this stuff came out just ahead of the approval they sought to give the shots to children. It starts
right.
to look like this was a very organized thing. But
yeah,
a subset of that, comment on that, and then I'll give you part 2.
Yeah, it really is unadulterated fear-mongering. Okay. And it's fear mongering so that they could drive people to get the vaccine. Get the vaccine or you'll die. And the second round of COVID supposedly was an epidemic of the unvaccinated. Well, that was patently wrong. That was false. And that's part of the problem, is that we need to get comprehensive, accurate information out to the healthcare providers in a timely fashion. And we just didn't have that. I still don't know, Cheryl, whether or not COVID is any worse than the flu, because we don't have accurate case mortality rates. And in the different populations, it's really clear that young adults don't have this problem. In the Spanish flu pandemic in 1918, the young people actually were specifically hit. The young soldiers were devastated. It devastated all those people that were going to World War One from the U.S. to Europe. This disease was not like that. It didn't affect young people very much. It didn't affect young adults at all. And it was primarily elderly and obese patients. But that it took too long for us to develop that. It took too long for us to find that out.
Well, I've been looking for a good fatality rate for COVID. And what I want is not the average or even what
Right.
it was at the beginning. I wonder what it is now, because I'll bet it's near zero.
Yeah.
And the initial rate, which would be, I assume, the worst when it first came out and when they were counting things that weren't necessarily, by the way, COVID deaths, but even Dr. Fauci got caught, I caught him, giving testimony to Congress that saying the fatality was 10 times worse than flu. At the same time, he'd published a scholarly article that said it was like a bad flu season.
Right.
So I couldn't get to answer the question as to which is it, Dr. Fauci? He went back and forth in public saying the worst thing, but in the scholarly article saying quite the opposite.
No, absolutely. I think that that saying misinformation like that is just awful, and so the response, you know, is terrible. We still don't know what the like you said, what the fatality rate of COVID versus influenza is, and I think that just having a very clear, simple answer: what is it in neonates? What is it in young children? What is it in teenagers and young adults? And what is it in older people? I'd just like to know a comparison. How much worse or not it was this disease than a flu, and we don't have that information.
When you said minorities seem to be impacted, so we know elderly people, and we know what was the other category? Oh, obese people.
Right. Yeah.
You mentioned minorities. Would this be an effect of minorities theoretically not being able to get as good of treatment, or being? Are there minorities that are unhealthier as a population? And what minorities are we talking about?
Primarily African American inner city people, and you know, it's a combination, because a lot of them are overweight, and a lot of them have had poor health care for whatever reason, and so they're actually sick with a lot of underlying disease, and then you throw the COVID virus in, and they just really can't handle it.
Wow. So moving on to the solution, when you were talking about make this
Right.
sort of a declaration of war, I know you've put some thought into this. Can you just give some of the mechanics of how something like that would work? Let's say we get on the front end of another potentially emerging pandemic. What happens?
Right.
What kicks in?
Well, I mean, Roosevelt went to Congress on December the 8th after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, and he asked for a declaration of war, which was overwhelmingly approved. There was only one congressperson that didn't vote for it. And so that kind of gave a national consensus. He's got it. We have our marching orders. And there has to be something that has to come as a consequence of that. And one of the main things is, how can we get scientific data quickly? And also, how can we do clinical trials? And I think the clinical trials part of it is something that, once a pandemic has been declared, then hospitals are organized in a method to be able to quickly find ways of improving outcome. So hospital A treats all their patients with steroids. Hospital B treats all their patients with hydroxychloroquine. Hospital C treats all their patients with ivermectin. And then you can quickly figure out whether or not the mortality rates are lower for any one of those possibly effective therapies. And so you can quickly prove or disprove. If it doesn't work, fine, we go on to something else. But we don't have that mechanism right now. We have to go to our institutional review board. We have to get their okay. Then we have to ask the patients to consent to be in a research trial. And I'm afraid in an emergency, that just takes too much time.
So someone, would the president go to Congress, or a member of Congress would bring it up and say,
no, the
let's
president,
have a declaration of war that will kick in these special things?
Yes. Yes, the president would go to Congress and ask for a declaration of war, and then the Congress would have to pass it. And then if the Congress passes it, then the representatives of American people have their representatives discuss. So it is representative democracy. You're not being ordered to do something. You agree to do it. And I think most people that are patriotic or even that are self-interested in trying to limit the damage of a pandemic would be quite in favor of that. And then if it lasts for a year or two, then the population is going to say no more, and that can be stopped. So I think that in order to have cohesiveness, we have to have our representatives in a representative democracy tell the patients that we are willing to allow our civil rights to be abridged during this emergency.
I feel like prior to the COVID pandemic, something like that, people may have trusted something like that more, but I worry now that based on the COVID experience, even the notion of having our representatives declare something or vote on something, there's just going to be a lot of mistrust among people who saw what happened last time, among their government officials.
Well, I think that's true. But again, I think that if you do it this way, if people sort of rise up and not revolt, but say no more, no mas, then the Congress goes and said, okay, the war is over. And then all of the constitutional rights that might have been abridged are returned, so that we're not in this unending, time unlimited mechanism for restricting civil rights. I mean, they stopped everybody working. When I was driving into the hospital every day, and when I drove in from the suburbs to downtown Detroit, it was like a ghost town. There was nobody out. I mean, the entire country was completely shut down. And that obviously has enormous economic, financial, health circumstances that really need to be agreed upon by the public.
And in the end, looking back, it seems to be, maybe I'm wrong about this, but a lot of scientific agreement, real scientific agreement, that the shutdown didn't really help mitigate things. It just created these bigger problems. Do you think the shutdown helped, or was a good idea at the time?
No, I don't think the shutdown helped at all, because I think what happened is people are social beings and they go out to, gather together with family and stuff like that, and the virus spreads just as easily that way. So I don't think it worked at all. And in places like Sweden, really had very minimal restrictions, that they didn't have any worse outcomes. So I think the consensus is that it didn't work. The other thing that Marty McClary, I think, is talking about is immunity for, the natural immunity, and that whole thing was downplayed, which was incorrect.
Well, that's true. I mean, and I try to do quite a bit of reporting on that, because initially there was a lot of thought that the faster that could happen, the better. And then it's as if it went off the table and it was not discussed by our officials that there was a thing such as natural immunity. And again, the Amish experience.
Yep.
They let COVID run through without doing a lot of mitigating things and vaccines and isolation. And the government, or some scientists, in my view, based on my experience, set out to try to prove that they fared worse because of it. And the most they could do by jacking up the numbers as much as possible artificially was to say that no more Amish died than the regular population. But they build that in the study that they released as if it were a failure, like as if all these Amish had died. But when you dig into the numbers, the worst they could make it sound was that no greater number of Amish died for having ignored the CDC recommendations. So the takeaway to that to me was, you mean they did nothing and didn't devastate their economy and stayed open and didn't devastate their schools and had no worse outcome? That's huge. But that's never been publicized that way.
No, I think the worst thing that can happen in science is scientific bias. And if you're out to prove a point, you will, because you can sway data and information in any way that you want. And you have to have some unbiased measures of being able to look at outcomes. That's why we do randomized trials. And that's why I would be hoping that if we did something like a declaration of war, that we could do very simple randomized trials where you get one therapy or another, and then you see which is better. That's laborious, and it costs. And the cost would be borne by the government so that we could really come up with some very basic information about whether things like standing 6 feet apart were efficacious or not.
Well, let me throw a monkey wrench into the mix of this idea again and say, let's say one hospital gives only, hydroxychloroquine or remdesivir or ivermectin. Yep. They're all testing these things. won't the hospitals in today's environment be pressured by insurance slash pharmaceutical industry, whoever pressures them? Well, don't do that. You know, if they don't want hydroxychloroquine to be tested and be proven effective, won't the hospitals go along with who funds them and gives them money versus the scientific community at large?
No, I think that the doctors have goodwill and they want to try to do what's best for the patients. And that's why we go into medicine, really, to try to help people. And the funding, I think, would have to come from the government in terms of, a lot of people don't understand how expensive it is to do this research, because when you start doing a trial, you have to hire a bunch of people to go out and talk to the patients and to collect the data and follow the patients very carefully, and then collate the data and then get statistical analysis. And that costs money. And if you don't have the funding, you just can't do the studies. True. So I think that the funding source would come from the government. And I think that the doctors would be quite willing to find the science. I mean, it infects all of us. A pandemic affects us, our families, our children, and we all want what's the best. And we all want to figure out what's going on and see if you can find a cure as soon as possible.
Much more after a short break.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Introducing Whipped Seafoam Body Butter by Sirenae Cosmetics. Hi, I'm Star, owner of the Lemonade Mermaid. Enriched with the nourishing powers of cocoa butter, mango butter, and shea butter, our body butter whisks you away to a world of deep hydration. Experience the essence of the sea with every application, as this whipped delight leaves your skin refreshed, replenished, and ready to conquer the day. Visit thelemonademermaid.com and make your skin sing with the magic of the sea.
Was it true that hospitals got paid for the more serious patients, or the ones that were on respirators? Not to suggest anybody would do that on purpose to make money, because the thought would have been if they were taking the more serious patients, they would need some assistance. But it may have turned out to have been an incentive in some way. Was that really happening? I could never find any data on that.
No, that would have been too organized, and that wasn't happening. The hospitals were struggling to stay afloat. I think what happened is that when you put a patient on a respirator, it's because their oxygen level is low, and they use something called positive pressure to try to force oxygen into the lungs. That wasn't the problem with COVID. The problem with COVID is that there's small little clots that were going into the lungs. And so even if you put the patient in the respirator, they really didn't improve. And the doctors, the pulmonologists, to their credit, figured that out relatively soon. So in the first wave of the pandemic, tons of people were on respirators. In the second wave, very few, because people started using anticoagulant, blood clot dissolvers to try to treat the patients. And there are many few patients on the respirator in the second and the third wave, because I think they kind of learned how to treat it better, and they started turning patients over and doing prone positioning, a bunch of things that really then prevented them from going on respirators.
And not to leave hydroxychloroquine too quickly, because I think people listening might say, well, I've heard studies say it's terrible and doesn't help, and I've heard studies say it's great and works. What are people to believe when they're getting just sort of mixed or opposite views?
The honest answer is we don't know. because we're just as ignorant as we were at the start, because there was never any properly funded trials in the U.S. to show whether it worked or not. And there was no funding because the NIH wouldn't back it, and there's no pharmaceutical company that would pay for it. I mean, I struggled. We tried to do a study here in Detroit where we're using the drug as a preventative. It's usually used as a preventative for malaria, so we're trying to do what's called prophylaxis. And there was never a really good study because we couldn't get funding, and because then hydroxychloroquine became a dirty word. I don't know where the heck that started. The drug is very safe. And it's never to be proven. It's never proven to be dangerous in COVID patients. Yet everybody thinks that when we started doing the trials, the FDA had this emergency authorization to allow us to use the study. They rescinded it in about 3 months based on fraudulent data that was published in the New England Journal. And then once the FDA rescinded the authorization, it was impossible to get people to even participate in a trial. Even the doctors were really worried about being in the study because it was labeled as being dangerous.
Well, a little bit of context, if I remember correctly, remdesivir, which was the favored drug by the government, I guess a newer drug, I think it was originally crafted for Ebola, but never FDA approved at the time.
Right. Right.
And the government and Dr. Fauci were acting as though that had great promise. And a lot of people had turned to hydroxychloroquine, and some early studies had shown that that might be good. But all of a sudden, the government takes these steps that basically, you know, destroyed the environment for hydroxychloroquine and put it on more equal footing with remdesivir, which is an injectable drug, I believe, given in the hospital mostly later when people were pretty sick.
Very expensive.
And expensive. Whereas hydroxychloroquine, cheap, could be given early, or should be given early, in fact.
Right.
But
right.
They suddenly said, the government, okay, anyone who wants to take hydroxychloroquine, which could be so dangerous now, can only do it in a hospital setting, which ensured it would be to people late in the game when hydroxychloroquine probably doesn't help them. So it would make the stats look bad for hydroxychloroquine. I mean, it just seemed like an engineered environment that the government did to try to make people, you know, lean one way over the other.
Well, I think if you kind of take back a sober look, a retrospect, I think that there was a lot of failures. There was failure for us to get a reliable test for COVID early on, and that took far too long. And there was a failure of the CDC to really send out honest data. I mean, everybody was relying on the Johns Hopkins data, and I think we know more about COVID from the Israeli experience than we ever know from the U.S. So that's my biggest concern. My number one concern about the next pandemic is, can we get timely, accurate information out to give us some sort of concept about how deadly the disease is and which populations are the most suspect and have the most risk. We need that right away. And the next one is not going to be COVID-2. It's going to be a different virus with different natural history and different response. But we have to figure that out really quickly.
So that sort of maybe kind of answers the takeaway. But if you had to sum up what you want people, sort of the message they should learn from all of this looking forward, what would you say that is?
I think that we had a poor response. We were completely ill prepared for this, and we still have not gotten prepared for the next one. And I think that that's really the message. I think people really should try to, talk to their representatives and say, "Hey, wait a minute. What is our battle plan for the next pandemic?" And we don't have one.
Are other doctors of influence concerned? Do you speak to colleagues that have similar thoughts?
No, Cheryl, I went back to cardiology. I'm trying to treat massive heart attacks now. And you know, that's kind of where my role in life is. And that's what I'm going to be concentrating on right now. And, you know, we've got phenomenal infectious disease doctors that should be the ones that kind of lead this.
Well, thank you so much for your thoughts. I think that's super valuable and helpful to people to hear. And I do think people should pay attention and speak up, because the change doesn't seem to be coming from within the government or the public agencies, or even by themselves within Congress, which promised an overhaul of CDC after all the problems, and yet hasn't taken any steps, as far as I can see, to do anything like that. So thank you.
I agree. My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
In this age of a highly controlled media landscape, it's never been more important to fight the heavy hand of censorship and support truly independent journalism. go to CherylAxon.com and click on the store tab for a great way to do that. There are all kinds of fun and functional products designed specifically for independent and free thinkers like you, featuring slogans like, I tested positive for critical thinking, and I need to find some new conspiracy theories, all my old ones came true. Proceeds support independent journalism causes like the Ion Awards for off-narrative accurate reporting. Go to CherylAxon.com and click the store tab today. Thanks for listening, everybody. I hope you enjoyed today's podcast and that if you did, you'll leave us a great review, subscribe, and share it with your friends. Check out my other podcast, Full Measure After Hours. And now you can support independent journalism causes by visiting CherylAxon.com and clicking on the store tab. There are some thought-provoking and fun products designed exclusively for independent and free thinkers like you, such as products with the slogan, I need to find some new conspiracy theories. All my old ones came true. Proceeds benefit independent reporting causes. Do your own research, make up your own mind, think for yourself.